Min campus alihor. Miai Karsten Schwine. Nilqakom għal-programm ieħor il-11-il wieħed fit-tieni sensiela tal-programm minn Campus għalieħor. Kif drajtu programm għalieħor li niltaqgħu ma' numru ta' professjonisti, letturi, akkademiċi, riċerkaturi, anki studenti illi b'xi mod mexxuna pass pass tul l-żvilupp tal-karriera tagħhom, l-interessi tax-xogħol tagħhom, tar-riċerka, tal-professjoni li jkunu fiha, ċertu drabi juruna kif wieħed ma jippjanax kollox minn qabel, imma jieħu l-opportunitajiet li jinqalawlu u għalhekk jiżviluppa iktar ħiliet u iktar interess stess u anki network ta' kollaborazzjoni ta' il-qasam partikolari jew anki oħrajn, forsi relatati ma' dak il-qasam primarju, u l-każ tal-programm tal-lum huwa proprju dan. Ħanitkellem kif nagħmel f'okkażjonijiet oħra ma' xi ħadd akkademiku, riċerkatur u anki manager ta' proġetti Maltija li tinsab barra minn Malta, nitkellem fuq Elain Azzopardi li xogħol tagħha kif ħa nisimgħu ħadha f'postijiet vari u mhux biss fuq l-art imma anki taħt l-art u anki taħt il-baħar għaliex ix-xogħol primarju tagħha dan l-aħħar sar propju l-arkeoloġija marittima u l-eskavazzjoni ta' taħt il-baħar. Hija bbażata l-Università ta' York. Però fatajdenna għamlet numru ta' xogħol ta' proġetti kemm bejn l-Università ta' Malta imma anki Università oħra barra minn Malta. L-isfond tagħha kif għedtilkom huwa dak tal-arkeoloġija marittima partikolarment fil-Mediterran u l-iskavar taħt il-baħar, il-BA honors tagħha u l-MA huma mill-Università ta' Malta, kif ħan nisimgħu titkellem dwar l-esperjenza tagħha u hekk proprju f'dan il-campus. Bat għal ftit snin ħadmet freelance bħala arkeologa f'Malta. Imbagħad ingħaqdet mal-National Facility for Scientific Diving in-NERC ġewwa l-Iskozja fl-2008 fejn l-esperjenzi l-Iskozja, l-esperjenzi l-Ingilterra u x-xogħlijiet tagħha ta' riċerka, ta' pubblikazzjoni, ta' lecturing, ta' kollaborazzjoni, speċjalment forsi dawk li huma propju fis-settur jew mitla tas-settur tal-arkeoloġija, l-elementi xjentifiċi tal-arkeoloġija jafuri ħafna xogħol isir propju meta inti qed tagħmel iskavar ir-riċerka u fil-każ interessanti ħafna ta' Elain anki bid-dimensjoni marina u marittima. Għamlet ħafna xogħol anki bl-użu ta' teknoloġija propju fil-qasam marittimu, l-oċeanografija pereżempju jew it-tfittix u sampling u l-immappjar ta' postijiet li kif ħan nisimgħu mhumiex faċli tilħaq. U fil-fatt irrakkuntanna kemm tħossha xogħlieta kuntenta li tagħmel propju dawn it-tip ta' xogħlijiet. Issa ftit żmien ilu kienet ukoll parti minn team tal-Horizon 2020, proġett kbir, framework kbir ta' proġetti Ewropej. Il-proġett kien jismu Pericles, Preserving and Sustainably Governing Cultural Heritage and Landscapes in European Coastal and Maritime Regions, u fil-fatt kien propju frotta dal-proġett u ta' l-kollaborazzjoni li f'Malta kienet bbażata anke mal-Università ta' Malta partikolarment, però ma' Marsa Xlok, ma' jkunu Marsa Xlok, u ma' nies li fil-fatt ġieli intervistat ukoll għall-Campus FM fuq sensijiet oħra. Allora, nisimgħu ftit l-esperjenzi ta' Elain Azzopardi li ħataqsam magħna qabel ma nagħmlu dan nerġgħu nikkumpanjaw ruħna ftit bil-mużika tal-proġett Mediterranju Medinea. we're back with our listeners of Campus FM to this further program. We're already on number 11, the second series of Min Campus Alihor, loosely translated as sort of connecting campuses, campus hopping, and other versions I like giving in English of this program on Campus FM. As our listeners also got used to the format of the program, I give an introduction in Maltese, sort of a local hook at the beginning of the program, and then wrap up as well, while then having a conversation with the guests of that particular program. As listeners will have maybe guessed or already understood, my guest today is Elena Tsopardi. Hi, Elaine. Thank you for being with me on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
We're connecting myself, University of Malta, yourself, University of York in the UK. We'll be seeing a little bit with you the various sort of steps. Like many guests on the show, listeners will be able to relate sort of to the rather undulating, zigzag, up and down, sometimes even roller coaster route that a professional career in academia and research, in areas which link sort of areas which impact directly and feed into policy and also other areas of our social practice, but sometimes linking it to maybe personal, particular stories, anecdotes. Because after all, as our listeners know, students, young, even older, people who are maybe at various crossroads of their careers and changes in their professions, it's interesting and it's sometimes consoling, sometimes it's inspiring to hear different stories and know how, so there isn't one way, there isn't one route which people take in order to develop their interests, be they academic or maybe more in the field of management or project management or others. It's rather more diverse. And in your case, Elaine, I think, like other guests on the show, you really sort of fit this very diverse, open, wide bill, because you've been through various steps. Obviously, on a local level, there's the interesting local hook and dimension. But not to take up more time myself, I'd ask you to take us through maybe the early steps as well of how you started following this career path in a way like the yellow brick road leading all the way to us. Sort of, we know how Dorothy and all the characters in Bond's novel and then in the famous Hollywood movie with Judy Garland sort of went through a number of adventures and trials to get there. What about yourself? Where did your road start from?
So it's definitely been an undulating road. And before I go into the sort of timeline, I think I didn't see this coming. When I was a student, I always thought you studied your degree or your subjects and then you worked in that area and that was it. You know, not in a bad way. I just thought it was really straightforward. And I have colleagues who have followed that path, but mine just wasn't like that at all. So it's been fun, I have to say. I think when I was younger, when I was a student, I would have been stressed by the idea of not a linear progression. I would have been really stressed.
Not being able to see sort of what the next steps would be.
Yeah. It's stressful if you can't see what's coming or if it's not directly. You think, oh, I've wasted all these years of study. That's never the case, never. So looking back on it, it's been good. But let me rewind a bit. So I guess growing up and throughout secondary school and things like that, I always loved sciences, completely obsessed with sciences. When you have to choose your stream in secondary school, I went to chemistry, biology and physics and followed that way through. And as all I knew was that I was going to be a scientist of whatever, or a doctor or a vet or something like these things.
And your early schooling, Elaine, was in Malta and private,
I was
primary...
in a,
and then secondary schools and sixth form. So
that's the Maltese school system. I was in a church school in Hamroon.
Okay.
And then went to junior college and then to the University of Malta. And I did sciences in my A-levels as well. I kept following that idea that I was I just loved them.
And you went through the system where sort of there was already, as you suggested, so this quite, relatively speaking, early choice.
Whereas yes.
Children are encouraged or sometimes made to choose certain areas, not others, in spite of sort of moves towards a more wide syllabus and curriculum, then one makes one's choices.
Honey, but then when you go into junior college, at the time, I don't know what it's like now, to be honest, at the time you had to choose subjects from different categories. So you weren't allowed to only do sciences.
Yes.
You had to do a language, you had to do systems of knowledge. And I think that was brilliant. It gives you a broader knowledge base, a wider perspective on the world. I think that was great. And you don't find that everywhere. So I appreciate that. Probably moaned about it at the time, but I appreciate it now.
Looking back.
So I did sciences in A-levels. But then when it came to signing up for my university course, I was a bit nervous about doing chemistry at university level. Wasn't my strong point. I would have done it in order to be able to continue with the biology. But that summer, the summer before you sign up for your course, I was looking through a newspaper and it was just one of these moments of serendipity. And there was a full page spread of a photograph of an archaeological excavation in Tasilj in Marsa Shlok. And it showed the students excavating. And this just blew my mind really bad. It was amazing. And I thought, wow. Imagine being able to do that. Imagine being able to excavate something so amazing. So I quickly looked up the archaeology degree requirements and they're pretty broad. And I figured I could apply for this. So I did. I signed up for archaeology, surprising myself and my whole family. I was a bit nervous. I won't lie. I was completely intimidated.
Well, I can imagine because possibly even maybe with friends, with colleagues. With family, sort of being sort of always interested in the sciences. And then archaeology, possibly at least people, colleagues, friends of mine who are archaeologists or pursue, let's say, the field of archaeology might have come from other areas, maybe more history, classical studies, Latin and Greek, rather than the hard sciences, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, I'm just completely breaking with what I've said for years and years and years. Oops. But I was just so excited by this topic. And luckily, they accept a broad range of applicants. You know, that's a credit to the course, I think. And also, so I was excited, intimidated, nervous, questioning myself, you know, all of these things. I think that anyone signing up to university probably is.
Yes.
But I again, at the time, you have a month to change your mind. I don't know if that's still the case. So you can switch courses in the first 4 weeks. So I thought, if I don't understand a single thing that's going on, I'll consider changing back to what I thought I was going to do. The first few weeks, I mean, everybody was lovely, really nice. It was a small group, super welcoming. So like all the years were having classes together. So you got to learn from the 4 years.
Okay.
And you thought, wow, maybe one day I'll know as much as these these students. I just loved it. But one early memory was we're looking at pottery, which is core to a lot of what archaeology does. And there was a fingerprint in the base of the piece of pottery I was looking at. And that, again, that just convinced me to stay, even though I was intimidated. I didn't have the background knowledge that everybody else did. I just thought, well, you know, I'll catch up.
It's interesting, as you're mentioning the, as many times, sort of inspirational teachers, lecturers, professors, people who leave their mark in academia, but even in other walks of life. So I guess at the time, you have people like Professor Bonanno.
Yes, Professor Gambin,
so you'd have a sort of a team of people who are not only good at what they know, but also how to transmit it.
Excellent teacher. Educators, I guess, you know, rather than tell you facts, they encourage you to think for yourself, to learn how to research, to how to think, which is really important in university degrees.
At the end of the day, isn't it? So it's the perfect base to then, if one wants, pursue areas of academia research, even applied research, in terms of projects and how to run them. And we'll get to that because... possibly one of the ways I got to know a little bit more about you before, you know, sort of speaking before preparing for the program, was through sort of project work that also, in a way, took you back, without wanting to jump the gun, but took you back to the sites in and around Marsa Shlok. So we'll be coming to that later on as well. So, Elaine, once you sort of made up your mind, and I guess sort of you started also feeling that, yes, that was a good choice and that was the place to be. Did things then sort of run smoothly from then on? Or again, was it a matter of having to keep on your toes?
In the degree, you mean, or like since then?
I would think both in the degree, but even more than that, maybe, because if one pursues a degree, I mean, one can do many exciting things at university and in academia, but sort of work a bit with what the Italians call paraocchi, sort of the English word fails me, but sort of those blinders which point you in a direction. And you could be doing anything, but go very much in one direction. In your case, you've kept quite a wide angle. That's what I understand.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, the degree was fun. I mean, it's hard work. All degrees are hard work. You have to put the work in. My fellow students were great. Like, we're still friends now, which is really lovely. And I follow their own careers with a lot of interest as well. But it was at the time at least difficult to find work. Again, it's the assumption you have in your head that I'm going to do my degree and I'm going to get a job. And then suddenly you go, oh, hold on, getting a job isn't so easy. And I did a lot of part-time work in the catering industry, the hospitality industry, as a lot of other people did, I'm sure, at the time, or still do. So I kept that ticking along. And there were contracts and projects and things like that. But like at the time, it's quite hard to get long-term work in archaeology. I don't know if the situation is different now. I suspect it is. But at the same time, so even though that was a bit challenging, I was also lucky that there was a lot of opportunities coming up. So I think it was just about the time that Malta had just joined the EU or was about to join the EU. So we got invited through Timmy, in fact, who worked really hard for this, Timmy Gumbin. We got invited on projects that took us on excavations to Algeria, to France, to Italy. So I was super lucky I got these opportunities just in the very early days. And I hope these kind of knowledge exchange things are still available for students. So that just, you know, on top of the way the degree expands how you see the world, just being in completely different places for a month at a time also expands how you see the world. And it sort of broadens maybe what you might consider, the thought of what you might consider doing yourself.
And I would think as well, apart from how you see the world, how you see also yourself in the worldview you're developing. Because spending a month here, there, you mentioned places like Algeria, which I'm sure are not the first thing young people think of as spending a month away from home in. So that also prepared, it must have prepared you also to consider what lies further afield. In the field of practice of archaeology.
Yes, for sure. And also living, so my mother is Irish as well, so I sort of brought up knowing Ireland quite well as well. I mean, Malta is home, but you know, you sort of brought up between two different places, which is interesting as well. So then I sort of took a year out to work a few contracts, again, the catering work, and did a research master's, which was a really nice experience. I very much enjoyed that. But after the master's, this sort of job situation hadn't really changed much. So then I thought, well, I love the sea. My research master's was in marine and maritime archaeology.
Okay.
What I also did as soon as I was old enough was to get a scuba diving license. I've always wanted to dive. So I saved up my money from my summer job and went and did it straight away. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just spend some time developing this strand and get a commercial license and just go and be a commercial diver. So I did.
So that was something you considered, worked for, did, and actually sort of pursued in a gainfully occupied
way. Yeah, I thought it's worth giving this a go. Because also, like, to work as a marine, for two reasons. First of all, to broaden the basis of work I could get. Secondly, because I thought it would be a fun challenge. And also to work as an archaeologist outside in many different countries outside of Malta, you need a commercial license. In Malta, I don't think you do. You can do on a sports license. So I thought, well, you know, if nothing else, it would be fun. It would be an experience.
Yes.
It would be a challenge. And it will, at least I can apply for jobs elsewhere. So I did that in Scotland in January.
it's not the first thing that would come to mind of going from Malta with the culture of scuba diving, going all the way north in January.
Yes. But, you know, once I decided, then I had to do it as soon as possible. But also there's a few areas in the world that offer these commercial diving tickets that are widely accepted. It might have changed since. And Scotland,
Scotland
was one of them.
Being one of them.
Uh-huh. And the first available place was in January. And I thought, well, if I can dive in Scotland in January, I can probably dive most places in the world. Baptism of fire. Why not? Have I go.
Yes. Elaine, mentioning this, we seem to sort of naturally have come to the first pause of our program today in Campus Eliahor on Campus FM, where my guest is Elaine Atsopardi from University of York, among others, as we're seeing, and as we will see even further. You've mentioned of baptism of fire, we've mentioned temperatures, and our first musical break very much leads us down that road, also in terms of energy and power. So can you tell us something about it and why you're choosing this track?
Okay, so this song is Mr. Fahrenheit by Queen, the greatest band of all time. and I suggested the song just because it's my favorite song and it's just joyful and fun, and I hope you enjoy it.
Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Queen and Mr. Fahrenheit there. It's always nice to hear a tune like that during Campus Eliahor on Campus FM. And my guest today, the person who chose that tune and is telling us a little bit more about her career, but also the personal steps taken in pursuing this career, Elaine Atsopardi. Elaine, we left you up in the cold waters of Scotland, getting your commercial license in diving. And what's striking me till now, probably even our listeners are sort of being hooked by this aspect. Always very curious, very open, but somehow knowing sort of what you'd like at the end of the day. And also certain decisions even at a young age, having been taken sort of with an ulterior purpose in mind, meant in a positive way, obviously. So thinking, yes, this can help me in the job market. This can help me pursue further work, not only locally in Malta, but also on a larger context. So that's let me not say not common, but it's not something you find in every student's thinking. In your case, it's really something positive, which has helped you, I guess, progress. Because now you might also tell us what the next steps were.
But this is but this is also part of it. It's like you don't necessarily know what's going to come out of it, but it's being open to giving it a go anyway.
Okay. So is it a bit like, I know it's a cliche, but is it a bit like sort of planting seeds?
Yeah.
And then seeing a little bit of what grows, what doesn't, waiting a little bit and taking sort of a feel of where things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, it's nice to challenge yourself a bit well, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway kind of a thing. I the first dive in Scotland was in a lake. I'd never dived in a lake before. It was freezing. I couldn't see anything. Inside, I was screaming. I was terrified. But I wasn't about to show that because I was the only girl on the course and I wasn't going to bail out. So you just challenge yourself and enjoy it.
Elaine, in fact, one of the elements which I guess a story like yours might also address is the gender element. Generally, I don't like sort of to pick on particular elements of people or sort of characteristics, be it any type of demographic, because of it's the person more than it's the person because of their this gender or this ethnic group or whatever. But with maybe knowing a little bit of the background with the Maltese context, sort of the sciences, archaeology, something like doing the course you mentioned. Possibly even the next step you'll describe to us. Was that another challenge you would say maybe others wouldn't have had to face in your case, being a woman?
All I can say from my personal experience that everyone throughout the course and all that, I never faced any sort of differentiation based on the fact. In fact, I think there was more girls in the course than guys. I'm pretty sure, in fact. It's mostly when you start getting into things like the diving sector, which is very male-dominated. So, in fact, there's different levels of commercial diving you can do, and I stuck to the basic one that I needed to do archaeological or science work because I knew if I went all the way for offshore diving, I'd find it very hard to get a job. Also, I couldn't afford it at the time. I mean, I would have loved to just out of sheer curiosity. Yes. But personally, I don't feel I've been, penalized in any way.
Yes. Or having had to struggle extraordinarily more than
men, for example. But that, you know, somebody else might have had a very different.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, scenario.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. So, were the next steps sort of naturally following from your further development in the field?
Yes, it was a classic case of what Professor Frendo would have called serendipity. because I was during my course in Scotland, there was a few magazines in the school, and I was flicking through one of them. There was a job advert for a scientific research diver, and I was amazed. I didn't realize such a job existed. Imagine being paid to dive for research. How amazing. So I immediately applied. I didn't get that job. But it alerted me to the existence of another research institute that also had a dive team. And I wrote to them and they were just about to release a job. Adverts. So that went out and I had to apply for it competitively also in Scotland, which is where I am now. So I got the second diving job as a research diver. And I think I started in May of the year I finished my commercial diving course, and I didn't see any of this coming. So this is the thing. You take one step and you have no idea what it's going to lead to.
What struck me is really is in your case, so if it wasn't only once in a way, sort of lightning struck twice with an ad in a printed
That's true. You know, I hadn't spotted that link before. Maybe I should stop following the adverts a bit.
I mean, when you think of it in this day and age, sort of magazines, newspapers, they seem, it's been foretold that they'll die a slow, agonizing death. But well-placed and maybe being there at the right place at the right time, they can be very, very inspirational. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's a huge element of luck. And then something just sends you off on a different course.
Yes, that's right.
It's amazing.
That's right. So once you went through this passage fairly quickly, sort of professionalizing in a particular area and then moving on, what came next? And also maybe till now, obviously, in a program like this, we're halfway through our conversation here on Campus Alihor, where my guest today is Elaine Atsopardi, which of skimming, we're going quite quickly. And you're talking to us about a number of phases, a number of jobs, a number of research jobs. I wonder whether slowly, to stick to the marine sort of environment, we could go a bit deeper, also telling us a little bit where slowly all this work you did was leading you to in terms of your own areas of preference and research, and whether they went together, so your next steps with your research development.
So the research diving job, I think one of the advantages I had in the application process was that I had an archaeology background, and that was missing from the team. They were biologists and fish biologists and stuff like that. They didn't have an archaeologist, so that would be interesting thing to add to the team. So that came back. But then at the same time, it came full circle as well, because it was for science support. So I got to then like dip into my initial love of sciences a bit.
Yes.
I didn't necessarily do research myself, so I was a sort of support technician equivalent, but a diver. And the dive unit is part of the Scottish Association for Marine Science. So we got to support a lot of different research projects. So it could be anything like a carbon release project. So we'd release carbon into the seabed over a month and do lots of cores and all that sort of thing to see how the chemistry of it changed. We didn't do the chemistry, but we collected all the samples. Or you're doing things like dating. So you can date sediments. It's equivalent of tree ring dating, but across some certain shells of certain species. Or we take videos or photos to support research and all over the world. Like the majority of was done outside Oban, but we also supported the British Antarctic Survey in Antarctica. We supported projects in Baffin Island, in the Red Sea. It was amazing. It's an amazing job. So many opportunities. And then that's what led back to the heritage thing as well. So within SAMS, so the Scottish Association for Marine Science, there's a social science unit or set of researchers, and they look at the social aspects of marine science, marine governance, all of those issues. And the director at the time told me, they don't know that you're an archaeologist. You should get in touch. It was, again, one of these really fortuitous timings. So I did. I sent them an email, and the lead researcher said, I'm just writing this proposal about heritage projects. And I know social science, but I don't know heritage. And I thought, well, I'm an archaeologist, and archaeology and heritage are slightly different. So I had a lot of learning to do, but, he just brought me into this process. It was very generous of him. You know, not many people would necessarily have done that or had the time even to do that.
Yes.
And we won the funding, which is the Pericles project that is now just coming to an end, which is, I think, how we sort of met.
That's right. One thing before we move on to other things, including our second musical break, and then looking a bit more sort of at this recent, most recent phase and project work, and then sort of a couple of pressing issues around this area to mind, sort of issues like possibly social, political pressures, funding, which is always an issue, but even issues of maybe of climate and climate change, which influence all this world you operate in. There is a word which is coming to mind, which is of the complementarity, the importance of having a variety of professionals in pursuing a particular research project or any type of project, really, because in your career story, you've come across this and you've pursued it yourself. where somehow not having the same profile across the whole team is not a weakness but a strength.
Yeah, and absolutely, and there is an ongoing demand for interdisciplinary research, which is difficult to achieve. But it is also seen as a bit of a risk. Sometimes if you're a career academic, for example, it's difficult to find the correct journal to publish your papers in if they cover lots of different topics. But it just suits who I am. It just suits my interests. So if you're someone that is really focused on one thing, that's great. Go for it. If you're someone who's interested in lots of different things and you pick them up and run with them at different times, that also works out. You know, and it can link up to this growing demand for.
Keeping in mind also our audience, maybe younger students, but even others who might be at various stages of their career, of their pursuits, and maybe go through this where they realize that maybe they're opening up their vistas and interests, and maybe they are working with different people in different teams. It could be sciences, it could be humanities, whatever. But find that, yes, it might still be a bit hard to connect things. And even at the University of Malta, like other universities around the world, there is more effort made in order to connect different disciplines. It seems sort of 1 + 1 = 3. And you start connecting. But those challenges do remain. I guess even if you're a career sort of quite single-minded academic, it would be tough. But even if you're not, even if it's a person like yourself who loves new challenges and connecting the challenges, it's still going to be tough.
It's just brings slightly different challenges. I think it's important that everybody tends to come with it with good intentions, right? Nobody's, you know, trying to say, well, my discipline's better than yours, or if they do, then, you know, that kind of needs to change. But I think people tend to want to collaborate because the problems we're dealing with, I think the research is changing. It's, you know, there was a time where research could be learning about the world, and now it's more about like, wow, how do we solve these complex problems that we're facing now? Mm-hmm. And to solve a complex problem, you need different perspectives, different knowledges, different expertise. So I think that's increasingly the way forward.
Yeah. Elaine, we've come to the moment where we can sort of catch our breath again a little bit, surface to keep, again, the marine imagery going, and listen to the second piece of music. You've chosen Ludovico Einaudi. Can you tell us something about why his music? I remember having been lucky seeing a concert of his in Luxembourg a few years ago when he had the De Venire tour going on, and there are these sort of sounds that travel with you that enter your mindscape and open them up. And I think many listeners will be familiar with sort of soundtracks and films and even adverts, as we were joking a little bit before as well. What does Ludovico Einaudi's music evoke in yourself?
For me, it just evokes calm and peace, even when it's getting, you know, quite emotional. And it also very much reminds me of, you know, when I'm diving, the underwater is not quiet, but it can be quite peaceful. And it just reminds me a lot of when I'm outside in nature, which is where I love to be, whether it's underwater or not. That music just links to those emotions really, really well. He captures something really interesting in such a fabulous way.
Let's listen to a little bit of this then. Thank you. So we're slowly, slowly coming out from that beautiful, very atmospheric music by the Italian composer Ludovico Einaudi. Second track today on Min Campo Salih, or on Campus FM, chosen by my guest Elaine Azzopardi. Elaine, during the break and with that music going through our minds, I kept thinking of what you said just before the break, which was this nature element. Somehow it gives us a lot. Somehow we take a lot from it. Thanks to science, thanks to research, thanks to projects, we're all the time learning more. But you said something really interesting, one of the many interesting things you said actually before the break, which was so it might not be anymore the priority to just to learn about the world, but somehow how to face these challenges, be it climate, be it urbanization. I wonder whether you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, I guess so. So the project I'm working on at the moment is heritage based, but it's about the place of heritage in broader marine governance issues, which talk about marine planning, which is basically the expansion of industry across marine space, blue growth agendas, tourism. Also, you know, heritage practices like inshore fisheries, fishing communities, and how climate change or other threats can impact them. And it's a huge topic. And that's been very eye-opening. I've learned a lot from it, which has been great. But then also a parallel research strand that I'm working on is for my PhD. I haven't quite achieved a PhD yet. It's works in progress. It's about culture and ecosystem services. You know, when you say we take a lot from nature, that's the whole premise of the ecosystem services framework. What I'm interested in looking at is that how what the cultural elements of that are. You know, how does culture interplay with how we use the world? Because ultimately, the elephant in the room is that you can frame nature as benefits to people that we should protect for our benefits. But really, if nature doesn't survive, neither do we. We are completely dependent on it. It's an interesting and two parallel research fields that I get to work on. So I'm lucky.
Yes. On the one hand, there's also what you said. On the other hand, I'm also thinking a little bit of what we're engaging with now, which is sort of how do you develop and craft and communicate the narratives which somehow tell us a lot about the world, but also about ourselves and how we deal with the world. And from my understanding, even through a very general participation in STEM or STEAM projects with young people, especially, and even institutions very remote like MCAST or Explora, and so on and so forth. And this element of how to communicate one's understanding and one's engagement, to me, seems to be really, really growing in importance.
Absolutely. We need to share. I think sometimes as researchers, of scientists or natural scientists or non-natural, we forget that not everybody knows what we take for granted sometimes. So it's key to share these things. But also it's key for us to listen to communities that have their own knowledge. We need to listen to them and value what they're telling us. Well, it's not a question of like, look, this is what we're going to do and you need to do. It's like, wow, what do you know about the sea? You know, you've spent your whole life working on the sea. You tell me. I don't know. It is really key to build these bridges with communities. So management actions to tackle these problems, for them to be valid, need to, or perceived as valid, need to engage multiple stakeholders. And they're not just professional or research stakeholders. They have to be local communities as well. It's so, so important. And that was the key premise of the Pericles project, in fact.
In fact, we're mentioning Pericles again. And since we're down to the last few minutes, less than 10 minutes now, Elaine, coincidentally, while we're recording this at the end of October 2021, we just had the closing meeting in Marsa Schlock, a very wet, stormy Monday in Marsa Schlock, where it's plans had to be changed rather than being on the foreshore, removed into the Madonna del Pompei office at the back. Jordi Vargas Macias who's the project leader, was here to conclude everything. And I was happy to interview him also on another show recently, together with various stakeholders, both sort of born and bred and the fishermen and the, even tourist community, tourist operators, but even people from outside, ministries and local council and so on and so forth, from an institutional level. It's hard. It's really hard to try to put into practice the principles of integrated coastal zone management, keeping a balance. And I guess one thing which struck me, for example, from this particular closing meeting was in order to go beyond consultation, and consultation also meant in a little bit of a negative way, sort of where people already know what they want to do. They just get the go-ahead from people and the right ticks and the right boxes. But to go to beyond that is really, really hard. What's your take on it, even from a sort of scientific perspective?
Yeah, it is difficult. There's issues of power, I think, that need to be addressed, because power and obligations. So people try to do things because, I don't know, the legal framework has signed up to certain things. It must be delivered. But then, you know, people then represent their own interests, not in a good way. You try and be fair to everyone. One of the things I think research projects are quite funny, because they don't necessarily have power to deliver anything. We can make the recommendations, but we can create a space. Deliver the academic papers, reports, things like that. But we can create a space for dialogue. So I think what Jordi helped do, you need interest in participation, was to link people that hadn't necessarily previously been linked, at least not directly. And, you know, throughout all our other case studies in Europe for Pericles, we could do that to varying degrees, depending on the existing networks and frameworks at the time. So it is challenging. And I think there's maybe a clash of timelines. So if you have to legally deliver something, if you're an institutional body, government agency, this is what you must do. So to do that in conversation with local communities that are going to be impacted by it is difficult, but it must be done.
Somehow it's really clear in the way you're describing it, that sort of identification of the main challenges of the problems based on thorough research, but they're not stopping there, but actually sort of really trying to go, as the saying goes, sort of bottom up, and really looking at all the people who might have their own stories and narratives and expressions to make.
So one thing we found in Scotland, which is where I did the fieldwork, was that there's a sort of tradition, it's not quite the right word, of the way of involving the public is to put out a plan and open it up to consultation. But the plan's already been designed. So the public go, well, you're not really listening to what we say, because you've already designed it. You just want us to tick box what you're what you say you're going to do. So, you know, maybe we need to work on developing capacity to involve people earlier on, rather than in a sort of consultation process, which is seen as at the end of the process.
And so signing off.
Of something. So that there is that perception. And also there's a perception that when they do participate, they're not listened to anyway, because the people that draft the plan have certain obligations. So there's room for better communication. But you need transparency. And if you want people to be involved, you have to show that you're listening to what they're saying. Yeah, people are busy.
Fair enough. We're down. There's obviously much more to say in this, but maybe my concluding question, or a couple of questions, because we're down to less than the last 5 minutes of today's Min Campus Elihor, my guest on the show, Elena Tsopardi, are two sort of, one maybe a general thing, and two related to your next steps. So one thing I guess would be, another big challenge, together with everything that you mentioned, is funding. So from your perspective, sort of in the area you operate in, what are the prospects for funding of certain projects and the prioritization of certain areas over others? But maybe I can link that to your own next step. You mentioned your PhD and you mentioned related projects. So maybe you could sort of even try to, I know it's hard, but sort of trying to give a concluding note to what, where all this trajectory you've described is now taking you.
Who knows? I'm open to suggestions. Which I could, as has always been the case, you start and hope it goes somewhere you interesting at least. But yeah, funding's always an issue. I think the arts and humanities, broadly speaking, struggle more for funding than the sciences do. So I think more money is being put towards environmental challenge issues. So I think that's there will be more opportunities there. There's a need, a growing need for social sciences from any background. Always need more. Again, we would argue we're underfunded compared to the natural scientists. But we need both. You need the basis of evidence to then work mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. So I would say in the sort of environmental sustainability fields, there is growing funding. Hopefully the arts and humanities will also benefit from that. Fingers crossed. In fact, the Ocean Decade Heritage Network is really pushing for this. They're saying we need a broader base of knowledge.
Approach.
Yeah, yeah. They're pushing for funding through that. Yes. So hopefully there will everyone will see more money coming through. But you know that's wishful thinking. And then in terms of my research, so I'm researching at the University of York, which is in the UK, and they fund PhDs. So my PhD is part of a doctoral training partnership that's focusing on ecosystem services. So it's basically a paid job, paid research job, which is brilliant. So again, they're putting more money into training the kind of students with different disciplines. So they're putting money into funding this kind of approach. So at the moment, I'm lucky, I think, with funding. Mm-hmm. And I think the future is looking good for funding.
PhD,
PS, you know, is looking good for research funding. So, there are budget announcements being increased for that. But, you know, balance that against all the money that needs to be put into tackling climate change, part of which is research, and, you know, the whole difficult economic situation at the moment. So, yes.
Elaine, I thank you very much for sharing those thoughts and various of concisely, because there's a lot more obviously to be said. But I think for me, sort of a takeaway point is definitely on the one hand, sort of on a personal level, taking opportunities, saying yes, nurturing one's curiosity in those areas that one is genuinely interested in. And sometimes even going out of one's comfort zone, even if it means diving in a freezing lake in Scotland.
Why, absolutely.
Why not? On the other hand, within sort of the general context then, sort of this drive, gradual approach, sort of integrating disciplines. You did mention sort of the keyword of interdisciplinary approaches, which obviously have to be accompanied by teams that are funded and by expertise in those areas. So I've learned a lot. I'm quite sure our listeners also did. And I really thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to share these thoughts and ideas with us.
It's been a real pleasure. I hope it's interesting to someone or useful to someone. If anyone wants to ask me any questions, they can find me on the University of York. I'd be happy to engage in any conversations. The one thing I'd say is don't feel you have to know everything. Just bring what you can to the table and don't be afraid to say yes to opportunities. They're always fun.
Thank you very much, Elaine.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Kirsten.
Nittama li din intervista ma' Elaine Sopardi mill-Università ta' York fl-Oħrajna. Uġbitkom tagħtna ħafna stejjer u aspetti interessanti ta' xogħol anke ta' ħajjeta u nittama li tingħaqdu miegħi wkoll għall-programm ieħor fis-sensiela minn kampus għal ieħor il-ġimgħa t-tiela. Saħħit.